Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation, episode 85, recorded January 2nd, 2013. Dan Ariely. Triangulation is brought to you by Audible.com. To download the free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/triangulation. Welcome to Triangulation, our first show of a brand new year, and we've got some great people lined up for Triangulation. As always, this is our kind of flagship interview show on the TWiT Network, where we get to talk to really interesting, smart people and ask them about what's going on in the world and so forth. And it's a pure vanity project for me. It's just because I want to talk to these people, and I'm glad I can get them on. We're really glad to get this guest on. I've been trying to get him for some time, ever since I read his book, Predictably Irrational, which is an amazing book. It's why we make decisions. We think we know what we're doing, but we don't. The Hidden Forces That Shape Our Decisions, the subtitle. His newest book is about lying, which is even more interesting. The Honest Truth About Dishonesty, How We Lie to Everyone, Especially Ourselves. Say hello to Dan Ariely, joining us now. He's a professor at Duke and runs the Center for, what is it called, for creative, the Center for Advanced Hindsight.
That's right. Advanced hindsight, not just any kind of hindsight.
Advanced hindsight is you know ahead of time what you think you're going to think about what happened a moment ago.
Advanced hindsight is the idea that often when we find the results we find, people come and tell us, oh, yes, I knew that all along. But of course, they did not know it all along. Only in hindsight, they think they knew it all along. So the name is a tribute to the feeling you have sometimes when you hear something new, but you think yourself, you remembered it all along.
That is a flaw that we all have. It's nice if you can recognize it happening. I think I'm probably not alone in this. When I read Predictably Irrational, in some ways I felt like the scales fell off my eyes. You teach psychology, but also something called behavioral economics. And I think that's really what Predictably Irrational was about, was behavioral economics.
Yeah, and it's basically about the fact that in standard economics, we have assumptions about how human behave. We think that people have all the willpower in the world, no emotion, and perfect computational powers. And because of that, people can always make the right decisions. And in behavioral economics, we don't make these assumptions about people. Instead, we say, let's put people in different situation, in real situation, and see how they behave. And what we see often is that people don't behave in a perfect way. And of course, it's not a big surprise. We see lots of it in the marketplace. We see lots of it around us. But understanding the nuances of how we misbehave and the extent of it is actually quite interesting. And then to understand both what causes it and what can we do about it is the real crux of the issue.
You know, I'm just thinking back to the book, and I read it a few years ago when it first came out. Why the Wall Street Journal charges more for the online only edition.
Yes.
And charges less if you get the paper and the online edition, and why they have three prices. And as soon as I read that, I went, oh, they've been tricking me all along. I fell for it every time. Can you explain that?
Yeah. So first of all, let's take a step back. The reality is that making decisions about money is incredibly complex. You know, every time you make a decision about buying a cup of coffee, it's a decision about what are you giving up? What are you giving up in the future? But think about what a difficult decision this is. When was the last time you thought about it this way? This is called opportunity cost. What are you giving up in the future for the pleasure now? And we went to a Toyota dealership not too long ago, and we asked people, if you go ahead and buy this new car, what are you giving up in the future? And people had no answer for us. They never thought about it.
Right.
We pushed them. We said, look, something has to give. What would give? And the most people told us is if they buy a Toyota, they can't buy a Honda. They made a substitution in the same time frame, in the same product category. But the reality is that this substitution is between now and later.
Right.
They should have said this is going to be a week of vacation for the next 3 years and 700 letters and 13 books and so on. People have a really hard time thinking about opportunity cost of money. And by the way, it's only becoming more difficult because we have student loans and car loans and mortgages, and we hope that our salaries would go up in the future. So these trade-offs are incredibly complex. So that's on one side. On the other hand, we have to make financial decisions. So what do we do if we can't do it the right way? We do it the wrong way. What particular wrong way do we use to solve financial decision-making? We have a slew of them. There's a selection. But one of the more interesting ones is called relativity. And the idea is that instead of evaluating something in an absolute way compared to everything else in the world, its opportunity cost, we evaluate compared to one thing. Which one thing? The thing that is next to it and makes it a kind of sensible way to comparing in terms of ease of comparison. This is why we compare the prices to appetizers to appetizers, main courses to main courses, dessert to dessert, wine to wine, and beers to beers. I mean, when was the last time you went to a restaurant, you looked at the two wines, and you said to yourself that for the difference in price between those two, you could buy 4 gallons of milk, right?
Never.
We just don't make this comparison. We compare within a category. So this trick that you mentioned, it's called the asymmetric dominance effect. And the idea is that when you have two options that are very different from each other, you have a very hard time deciding between them. For example, imagine you have a subscription for The Economist online for $59. That's the example I used. Or you have a subscription for The Economist online plus the print version for $125. Those two are very different. Hard to compare. Is the first one worth $59? Is the combo deal worth $125? Hard to tell. What happens if you add another alternative that nobody wants? You said in addition to the print version with the online subscription, the combo deal, you could also have the print-only subscription for the same price, for $125. So now you have the online version for $59, the combo deal for $125, or just the print version for $125. What happens when you add this useless option of just print option for $125, many more people buy the combo deal. And again, it's the same thing. Is The Economist online worth $59? Is the combo deal worth $125? How would you know? How would you compare? Those two are too different from each other to compare directly. But if you add an option that is easily comparable and you can say, oh, I don't know how much this is worth, but it's clearly better than this deal, this relative kind of this relative evaluation gives it a boost, and now it looks much more favorable. And then if you look at relativity, you can see it everywhere. Think about something like sales. Why sales? Why would you possibly care what something used to cost in the past? It's irrelevant. But of course, it's about relativity. We say, oh, it's cheaper than it used to be. Irrelevant, but still a good input for our decision making.
And I always have in the back of my head, well, that's the sale price, but it's still more than I would have paid if it hadn't been the sale price. But because I'm getting a deal. I'm getting a deal because I get the combo price for the same price as the print paper would cost. That's a deal. In fact, it doesn't matter. It's irrelevant. Now, if people know this, do you find that they act more rationally? Or is it just a data point and they go, yeah, okay, but I'm going to keep doing it this way?
So I think there are decision biases that are more easily overcome and ones that are harder to overcome. And when we overcome decision biases, there are two ways to do it. One is to recognize things as they happen and say, oops, I see this trick happening to me.
Right.
And I get lots of people reporting this, particularly about the asymmetric dominance and also about free. So free turns out to be very tempting. When we give people a chance, get Jerry's ice cream, they get very excited. They do lots of things for this. Now what happens is that people can recognize these mistakes. And for example, when our emotions kick in, that are much harder for us to realize how they're working. And because of that, they're much harder for us to fight.
So, in other words, as soon as we get emotional, rationality, I mean, that's kind of how people think of it. Rationality goes out the window.
Yeah. Now, there's another category, which is a category of things that we do from time to time, and we can actually get those decisions to ask about something like automatic savings, taking money from your checking account and moving it into long-term savings. This is something that if you do one time, it will be helpful for you for a very long time. And it turns out that those are actually the places where we could combat making a decision one time, and it's going to be with us for a long time.
And we can get that. We understand that.
Yep.
How is it that marketers knew this all along? Uh-oh. Are you still there?
I'm still here.
Okay. There we go. We got the picture back. Sometimes Skype gets a little funny. The bandwidth's fluctuating a little bit. How is it that the economists knew this and that most people don't? Is this just kind of lore that's handed down? So
one thing is, I'm not sure that the economists really knew it or not. I tried to figure out if they knew it or not. It wasn't really clear to me if they knew it or not. But I think that marketers are trying lots of things. Some of them work, some of them don't work. Actually, it's very interesting because in some sense, when we show something that works, some people in marketing said, yes, we knew that. But when we look more deeply, it turns out that they also knew things that are not correct.
Right.
So I think science is useful even when we show things that people believe that they knew all along, because now they have a proof that this is working. And it's also important to figure out that there are things that are kind of common wisdom that don't actually work, and we need to think about them more carefully.
You have a great column in the Wall Street Journal, Ask Ariely, which people get to write in and ask you questions. And somebody asked you about Psy, about the Oppo Gangnam Style. People love the video even though they don't. It's in Korean, and there's only a few English words. They don't understand it.
Yeah.
And the questioner is saying, is it going to be a mistake that Psy's next song will be in English? Would that actually hurt him?
Yes, and my answer was that yes, I think so. And this was not a scientific experiment, but I'll tell you what I did. I went and I picked 12 very popular songs, and I just listened to them. And these are not songs I listened carefully to, but before. But I listened to these songs. And then what I did was I went and I searched for the words of those songs and I read carefully the words. So I knew what the words were. And in all cases, I was disappointed. Actually, I was. It's not an exercise that I'm recommending because I think it would decrease the quality of life. There are some things we should pay more attention to, maybe good food, more wine. And there are some things we should pay less attention to. And maybe pop music is one of them. I mean, I'm sure there's some exceptions, but to a large degree. So the question is, what happens when somebody is singing in Korean, and is your brain interpreting the information in an over-optimistic way? Actually, we have some results for this in a very different domain. We did some studies in online dating, and what we found is that when people knew very little about each other, we could only get information from your profile about who you are and what you're interested in, better. And as a consequence, they developed overhyped expectations. Then they met the person for coffee and mostly got disappointed.
You know, Ted Koppel observed this, the guy who started Nightline in U.S. Television News, he called it the Vanna White effect. People said, why don't you tell people whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, Ted? And he said, it's the Vanna White effect. People love Vanna White, the letter turner on Wheel of Fortune, because they know nothing about her. So they project all these good values on her. But
that's right.
And the same thing with me. If I don't tell you what my politics are, people think that mine are the same as yours. The minute I tell you, bad news.
That's right. So, for example, if we tell people I like music, people think you like the same music as them. say, I like the outdoors. They think you like the same thing. Now, it could be that you mean that you're a nudist. It could mean that you like skiing. But the way people interpret those things are in ways that fit with them. So there is this incredible bias. Now, what's also interesting in dating is that people don't seem to be better over time. And even people who are experienced daters get disappointed over and over and over. And this effect, by the way, of exaggerating expectation and getting disappointed is larger for women compared to men.
Wow. So is your advice not to date so much?
Well, no. I think there's a question of how we create overhyped expectations. And I think it's a very natural tendency. And in some sense, it's wonderful, right? I mean, you can listen to a song in Korean and get very excited about this.
Right.
We often have the tendency to want to fill in the gaps. So when you date somebody, of course, you have to fill in the gaps. So in the dating case, you want to work on not creating high expectations. In the case of observing something, we might want to leave details apart. We might not want to get all the little nuanced detail because they might actually turn us off rather than make things more attractive.
Ignorance is bliss.
Some ignorance, yes.
We're talking to psychologist and behavioral economist Dan Ariely, who is, if you haven't read his book, we're going to talk about his new book, which is about dishonesty, the honest truth about dishonesty and why we lie and how much we lie, even especially to ourselves. But before we do that, let me talk about one of our great sponsors who happens to have all three of Dan's books online. It's audible.com. I don't know if you listen to audiobooks. I am a huge audiobook fan. In fact, that's how I discovered Dan, listening to his book, Predictably Irrational, which came out in 2008, The Hidden Forces That Shape Our Decisions. Highly recommend it. Simon Jones reads it. And his new book, also read by Simon Jones, who has one of the most plummy British accents, he's just wonderful, is also on Audible. Now, here's how you can get one of Dan's books for free. Also, The Upside of Irrationality, The Unexpected Benefits of Defying Logic at Work or at Home. I'd start with Predictably Irrational and work your way through them in order. But that's up to you. We'll get you the first one free if you go to audiblepodcast.com/triangulation. You download the books literally in seconds. They're usually no more than about 100 megabytes. You can get the Audible app on your iPhone, your Android phone, or your Windows phone, and then your whole library is always available to you, which I love because I have literally more than 500 books in my library, including Dan's books. And you can listen to them at any time. You can go back and, in fact, I should have. Had I known, I would have been listening to Predictably Irrational again. So go to audiblepodcast.com/triangulation. And get your first book for free. There's 100,000 titles in every category: fiction, nonfiction, science fiction, young adult, children. There's even newspapers and magazines. In fact, with your monthly subscription, you get the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, one or the other, each day read to you. It's wonderful at the gym, in the car, wherever you're going. You always have time for an Audible book. It really brought literature and reading back into my life, and I'm just a huge fan. audiblepodcast.com/triangulation. So let's talk about lying, Dan. In a way, that's kind of what all of your stuff is about, is how we kind of trick ourselves, isn't it?
Yeah, so lying is a wonderful way to think about behavioral economics and biases in general. Because A, we do it, we don't see it happening, and we don't understand what causes it. And what's interesting in lying in particular is that our interventions are really misdirected. If you think about what kind of policies are we implementing to try and curb things like the financial crisis, or what kind of things do we create to decrease corruption, to decrease petty crime, to decrease large crime, all of those are misdirected because they have a very simple rational model. Right? Every time you create a policy, you have in mind the psychology of the person you're trying to control. And most policy makers think about the cost-benefit model. They think about people who say, What do I stand to gain? What do I stand to lose? Is it worth it?
So in effect, you punish lying, and you try to make the punishment great enough so that people will choose not to lie.
That's right. So, for example, you could say, let's give the death penalty. If we give the death penalty, everybody will behave well. Guess what? To the best of our ability, we can't find any difference between states in the U.S. that have the death penalty and say they don't have the death penalty.
Why is that? Do people just there? Is it that's the irrationality? Somebody who's committing a heinous crime doesn't think ahead of time, oh, I might get the death penalty for this.
Yeah, I actually think that in almost no human activities, we have evidence that people think about long term. Think about things like texting and driving, overeating, undersaving, drinking and driving. I mean, the amount of things that we do to show that we don't think long term are just incredible. And the amount of things that we do that show that we actually think about the consequences of our action in the long term are not very high.
Do we get better? I mean, that sounds classically like something young people are bad at long-term thinking. Do we get better as we age about long-term thinking?
So, you know, do you text and drive?
Yes.
Okay.
Not as much as my young daughter does, but yes.
But it's hard to tell, is it because she's more addicted to her phone?
Yeah.
Or is it because she's not as able to control her impulses?
Right.
By the way, you know, there was a very sad study showing what happens in states that regulated that it's illegal to do texting and driving. And what happened in those states is that accident rates because of texting and driving went up.
But that's not intuitive at all. Why would that be?
Because instead of texting over the wheel, people started texting under.
They still texted. They just hit it.
They tried to hit it. Now, this is really an amazing tribute to human stupidity.
Yes.
If you're passing a law, it's not as if anybody is saying, you know what? I want to text and drive. I think it's good. I'm hoping my kids will text and drive more. I don't think people do it enough. It's something that everybody recognizes incredibly stupid. Nevertheless, at the moment of temptation when your phone vibrates, people
behave.
That's
the problem, yeah.
Let's go back to cheating. You know, this idea that people do long-term thinking, the California three strikes and you're out, you can think about lots of those cases. I actually talked to some insider traders, some people who've doped in athletics, people who sold games, lawyers, all kinds of cheaters. Nobody from everybody I've talked to thought about the long consequences of their actions. Instead, it was a small action that they could take and rationalize to themselves. And then they took another step and then they changed and took another step. We look at the sequence of bad behaviors and we say we could have never done that. But these people did not think about it either. They thought about one step and then another step and another step. And unless we understand this progression of dishonesty, we're not really going to be able to create any regulations that are going to reduce it or eliminate it.
So what do you do instead of creating a penalty for malfeasance? What do you do? How do you? Because, I accept that. We don't think long term. We think about the short term immediate consequence. We're more worried about getting a ticket for texting than we are about running into the guy in front of us.
So first of all, if you think about this whole notion of large punishments, they basically say we're going to tempt people to misbehave and then we're going to punish them later for misbehaving. So think about conflicts of interest. Actually, here's a case. Imagine you're a banker. It's 2000. And I give you every year a bonus up to $5,000 if you could only see mortgage-backed securities as a good product. Now ask yourself whether with this kind of incentive, you're not able to see mortgage-backed securities as better than they are.
Sure.
Say, would you lie? Would you believe that they're awful and just tell your clients that they're good? Wouldn't you shift your actual beliefs?
Yes.
Of course you would.
Nobody wants to be a liar. So we just say, we rationalize in a way that we can say, they are better actually.
And what we show is that if everybody around you believe the same way and they're difficult to compute and you can tell a story about why this is good, all this is helping you further. Now, what we do in those situations is that we create tremendous conflicts of interest, right? If I put you in 2000 as a banker, you too would have misbehaved.
Sure.
Time. So. We create tremendous human nature to prevail. But the reality is that this is a very unlikely case. And instead, we need to recognize that maybe putting people in bad conflicts of interest to start with is not a good recipe. Rather than creating a bad situation and trying to fix it after the fact, we should try and eliminate the bad situations to start with.
So is that regulation or is that attempting to modify behavior? How do you do that?
So it's a lot of things. It's a lot of things. And I'll give you one other good news. So, for example, you're dealing as an individual with lots of people who have conflicts of interest. Your physician has have conflicts of interest. Your dentist have conflicts of interest. Your financial advisor, your lawyer, all of those people that you deal with, your mechanic, of course, all of those people have conflicts of interest. And the first realization is that you don't have to be bad people in order to succumb to these conflicts of interest. So you as an individual who might suffer tremendously sometimes because of their conflicts of interest, you need to actually be careful. You need to think about what environment you're creating, what are the conflicts of interest, how good is their advice, and can you reduce that conflicts of interest? Then there's the cases in which we have employees or businesses and so on, and we have the potential of people acting dishonestly. And then finally, there's the situation of policymakers. And in all of them, we have to think about it carefully. Now, here is kind of the most positive news from this research. And I'll start, I'll tell you a little joke. And the joke is that a guy goes to the rabbi. And he said, "Rabbi, you wouldn't believe it, but somebody stole my bicycle from synagogue." And the rabbi is appalled. He said, "I can't believe it. This is terrible. This is awful. I'll tell you what you do. Come to synagogue next week and sit in the front row. And as we go over the Ten Commandments, turn around and look at everybody in the audience. And when we get to 'Thou shalt not steal,' see who can't you look straight in the eyes? You'll know that's your guy, that's your thief." The guy is very excited. He comes to synagogue, sits in the front row, turns around during the Ten Commandments, looks at everybody in the eyes. After the services, he goes to the rabbi and he said, "Rabbi, you wouldn't believe it. It worked like magic. It worked like a charm. The moment we got to 'Thou shall not commit adultery,'" "I remembered where I left my bike."
I didn't even have to hear the punchline and start.
So what is the experiment here? We asked a group of UCLA students to try and recall the Ten Commandments.
Uh-huh.
First of all, it turns out none of them could, and many of them invented a new interesting commandment. And that, of course, might be a California-specific effect. Happened after they tried to recall the Ten Commandments, nobody cheated. So that suggests, and by the way, it has nothing to do with religion, because the amount of cheating doesn't correlate with the amount of religious beliefs. Hmm. And even when we get self-declared atheists to swear in the Bible, they stop cheating. So what it suggests is that people are actually inherently quite honest. In fact, if you think about it, we have lots of opportunities to be dishonest all day long, and we don't take the vast majority of them, right? So the bad news is we're dishonest. The good news is we're not as dishonest as the rational incentive would cause us to be. And what happened is that when we're reminded of our moral code, it's not about hell or heaven, believing in God or not. When we're reminded about the moral code just before we're tempted to misbehave, people behave better. And we also showed it with insurance claims and other things. So the moment you get people to think about their own morality, they behave better.
Wow. I don't know what the lesson is for lawmakers in that.
Well, the lesson is to think about how do you get people to act honestly at moments when they might fail. So intuitively, I think in some cases we understand it. Think about in the court case. You come to court, you put your hand on the Bible, and you swear. Mm-hmm. Start the whole testimony by basically reminding yourself about your own ethical standards.
And that works.
And that works. Think about other cases where you fill in forms. You fill the IRS forms, and only at the end you get to sign.
You should have them swear on the Bible before they start the form.
I think in the oral tradition of swearing and testimony, we actually understand how things work.
Yeah.
Because of that, the result is actually better. But as we get more legalized, it becomes less about reminding people about their own moral fiber and their own moral desires, and more about legalistic approvals, and it actually doesn't work as much. So think about what environment would you create if you wanted to remind people about their own morality just at the moment of temptation.
Right.
It would be a very different system than one in which you imagine people think long-term and take all the consideration into hand.
So maybe a shopkeeper should have a sign in the store that doesn't say we prosecute shoplifters, although that's probably more effective than nothing. But maybe something like what? You be honest. Don't steal.
Basically, think about your own morality. So there's lots of ways to do it. Yeah. I'm not sure which one is better. There's actually a beautiful experiment that showed that just getting people to see eyes printed, and they know nobody's following them, get them to reflect better.
Oh, wow.
So a shopkeeper, I would basically say, this is my livelihood. Treat it as you would want other people to treat your livelihood.
Boy, I think that would really work.
So the experiments basically show, I mean, if you think about it, a lot of the results on irrationalities are showing where we deviate from perfection. But the reality is that there's lots of wonderful things about human nature where we deviate from rationality, but not in the way that we want to fix.
Right.
People are generous. People are kind.
Right.
People give you time, advice, help you. People don't steal as much as they could.
Altruism is not rational. Although Richard Dawkins would say, you're protecting your gene. You're more altruistic the closer the gene pool is to you and things like that. But I don't think we think about that stuff at all.
We don't think about it. And, you know, people tip in cities that they don't intend to go back.
That's true. Tipping's a good example.
So there's all kinds of things. And, you know, if you go to a new city, it's not all of a sudden you become a selfish bastard. Right.
So,
by the way, restaurants are very interesting. In the last few years, every time I go to a restaurant, I ask people, I said, can you recommend for me a way to eat in this restaurant and escape without paying? And the waiters, you know, sometimes they ask me for my credit card first, but aside from one or maybe two times, they always give me good advice. There's a back alley, there's a bathroom, wait until a big party comes. I tell them I'm not going to do it, right? So it's clear I'm just looking for advice of how you would do it if you would do it. And it turns out they think it's incredibly easy to do. And then I ask them, how often do people do it? And they say almost never.
Yeah.
Now think about it. How would you feel if you were eating in a restaurant, somebody served you, somebody cooked, you consumed something, and at the end they said, you know what? 100% you could live without paying and nobody... You would chase you nobody knows because you would think of yourself as a thief if you do.
Right.
You would feel incredibly bad if you behave this way.
Right.
And then look at other behaviors. Look at something like illegal downloads. In those cases, people don't feel bad at all. They have no problem downloading stuff and not feeling bad about it. So we have these behaviors like restaurants when we're much better than the economic theory would predict. And then we have these behaviors like illegal downloads, which were exactly as selfish as the economic theory predicts. We don't feel any guilt. We don't feel any pain. It's just about the cost and benefit. And you know what? The probability of being caught is so low that nobody really worries about it. And nobody feels guilty about it. And there's no shame connected to it.
Right.
And as a society, we need to think about how do things become from food in restaurants to illegal downloads. And how do we not get this deterioration? And there's all kinds of areas which I think this deterioration is starting to take place. I think about plagiarism at universities, for example. Or I think about all kinds of things in the financial industry, like soft dollars and all kinds of terrible practices that kind of are stealing money and exaggerating fees and so on. And the moment those things become more normative in the sense that everybody is doing them, all of a sudden there's less guilt and they become a little bit more like illegal downloads, and then it's really hard to fight them.
I think the industry has started to understand, though, that if you give people the opportunity to pay and you remind people that there is that you're hurting somebody if you do something like download illegally, I think that that's actually succeeding much better than suing, putting people in jail, any of that long-term stuff. I think
absolutely.
I think you're right. If you were, so you say simultaneously that everybody lies, everybody cheats, but that we are mostly good.
Mostly. You know, it's kind of a question of. I think we're good to a very large degree, and there's a question of what is the environment that would get the good out of us.
Right.
And I think it's easy to get into a slippery slope of bad behavior, and for society to endorse it in a way that make it seem like that's the right way to behave. And that's a dangerous slippery slope. Think about doping in cycling, for example. I talked to some cyclists who doped, and they basically, not Lance Armstrong, by the way, I didn't talk to him, and they said that everybody's doing it.
Right.
They said just to keep up, you have to dope. It wasn't a question of legal or illegal or so on. There's just no other way. That was what everybody was doing. How could you not do it? It was part of the process. It was part of the game. So the moment things become like that, we could take our good nature and basically deteriorate it until we have something that we think of as corruption, which is that you misbehave, you know it's illegal, but you don't care.
There's so many areas where this is applicable. Can behavioral economics help us, for instance, with the economic crisis that we're in the world right now? Not just the U.S., but Greece, Europe. Is there any lesson there?
So I think there's a few lessons. One lesson, of course, is about conflicts of interest in the financial market.
Yeah.
And that's the lesson that we haven't really learned. And I just came back from Holland. I talked to the central bank there that are trying to regulate. And again, they think they're trying to regulate evil people. And I said, look, if people were evil bankers, were just trying to get the most money out, couldn't they steal much more than they stole? And they thought about it for a while and realized that, yes, the answer is yes.
Yeah.
So I said, okay, so if you're regulating mostly good people who sometimes misbehave, how would you do things differently? So that's kind of one direction, I think, understanding the financial markets, understanding conflicts of interest, understanding dishonesty. The second thing to understand, I think, is about how do you reset behavior? So think of Greece. People have not paid taxes in Greece for many, many years. The Greek government kind of cooked the books to get into the European Union, and everybody knows that, including the Greek people. Why should they start paying taxes tomorrow? Right? Why would tomorrow be different? And I think here you can take a lesson from the Reconciliation Act in South Africa, where you basically said, in order to move from an apartheid era to a post-apartheid era, they came up with the Reconciliation Act. They stood on the stage and they said, here's a list of awful things we've done in the past. We're sorry, we'll never do it again, and tomorrow is a new day. And I think Greece needs to do something like a Catholic confession version and start creating an important point in which tomorrow is different than yesterday. There's some referendum, some agreement, something about acting differently. And finally, I think that there's another important lesson in terms of the labor market. Right? How efficient are the labor market? What do people work for? How much is salary a part of compensation versus other things? How do you reward people? How do you get them to be motivated? We have this naive notion that people are just motivated by money. But of course, people are motivated by lots of things, pride, community, belonging, sense of accomplishment, sense of contribution, and so on. How do we tap more of those motivations and get people to be motivated in the workforce? If we think it's only money that motivates people, we have very few levers to to get the workforce to be more motivated. But if we understand the range of human motivations, I think we can do much, much better.
You can really see that in technology, where you have a whole open source community that's contributing and building something not for money at all, but for all of those other things you talked about. And I think it puzzles people because they say, but how do you make money at it? They keep asking that question. But where's the money?
And you know, what's interesting about the open source community is that a big part of the advancement has actually been legal. Mm-hmm. It has been the decision that every time you write a piece of code, your name is going to be connected to that piece of code forever. And nobody can use it for other things that you did not approve or intend. And basically now the software is your kid.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes companies worry about using open source software because they say, who will maintain it? You know what? People who created the software maintain it for years after nobody is using it in the hope that people... Social companies take a product, it doesn't really efficient, they dropped it like a hot potato. If it's your child, you would keep on investing in it, even if it's not economically efficient.
Exactly. Are you an optimist or a pessimist?
So you know, I think the more I study this field, the more I realize human irrationality. But the more I realize how much there is to fix. So think about the world. On one hand, I look at human irrationality and I say we're incapable. We don't know how to make decisions about money and health and security and voting and so on. We're just incapable. On the other hand, I like to think about the total state of the world and saying I don't want to think about this as a outcome of 7 billion perfectly rational people. Instead, I prefer to think about this as an outcome of 7 billion irrational people, which means that we can also fix and design things better and improve things. So I think behavioral economics for me is pessimistic about the individual human nature, but it's optimistic about the fact that we can actually create a better environment and get things to a better state. And here's another way to think about it. We find that one of the most important aspects of decision-making is the environment in which we place ourselves. You place yourself in an environment that tempts you with donuts, you'll eat more donuts, right? If
right.
I came every morning and laid your desk with donuts, fresh donuts every morning for a year, the odds that you would not gain weight at the end of the year is not very high. But the good news is that we are designing our own environment. And now we can ask the question of what environment do we want to design? One that gets the best of us or gets the worst of us? One that gets us to eat more donuts and one that gets us to exercise more. And I think that the more we understand human irrationality, the more we can design the environment for better outcomes.
I love it. So it's not to be more rational. Give that up. It's to embrace the irrationality, understand it, and do things that will work.
That's right. Now, you know, give up. I don't want to give up completely, but I think in many cases, it's a much easier path to do other things rather than to attack the problem face on.
Right.
So think about something like global warming. Can people wake up in the morning and care about something that is likely to happen in 100 years from now? Very unlikely. Very unlikely that any amount of education or, I don't know what, commercial or time and so on is going to change the vast majority of people to wake up in the morning and feel energized to do something about global warming. But we can do all kinds of things in the environment that make it easy, appealing, something that we want to do at the moment rather than for the future. And by designing the environment is where you get people to behave much better.
That is actually a very optimistic, positive message, because global warming is a perfect example of such a long-term consequence that unless the tide is rising up to your neck, people aren't going to do anything about it unless you, as a policymaker, you give them an opportunity to that makes sense. If you want to know more about Dan Ariely, he's done TED Talks. Go watch his TED Talks. They're wonderful. His webpage, danariely.com. But most importantly, he's got three great books. There's Predictably Irrational and his newest, The Honest Truth About Dishonesty, How We Lie to Everyone, Especially ourselves. And, of course, don't forget, all of them are on audible.com, our sponsor, but you can get them on Kindle and Amazon and everywhere else. Dan, it's such a pleasure to talk to you. I really I admire your work so much. And reading it is so refreshing. It's every page is like, oh, it's such great insight. I just love it. And I love it that you're using scientific method to drill down, not what we think or what we expect or what we predict, but how do we test this? Thank you, Dan.
Good day.
Take care. DanArielli.com. And I hope you enjoy Triangulation. We do this show Wednesdays, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 2300 UTC on twit.tv. Do watch live. I love seeing the chat room, and the feedback from the chat room is so valuable, especially on this show. It is Triangulation, me, a guest, and you. But if you can't watch live, don't worry. We make audio and video available after the fact always of all of our shows at twit.tv, of course, wherever podcasts are. Dan has – you don't still do the podcast, do you, Dan? For a couple of years, you were doing a podcast.
I have from time to time. I'm a little behind these days, but soon there will be new episodes of Arming the Donkeys.
Arming the Donkeys. Excellent. You must subscribe, and that way, if you subscribe, you'll get it when Dan puts out another one. Dan, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
What fun. And thank you for joining us. We'll see you next time on Triangulation. Bye-bye.